Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, blood supplies are in short supply. But up front, in early August, President Trump signed a memorandum allowing for the deferment of old age, survivors, and disability insurance taxes, or Social Security employee payroll taxes. This action was intended to put money directly into the pockets of workers, according to the president, while Congress deliberated a new stimulus package. Employers have the option to defer withholding the employee portion of Social Security tax payments from September 1st, 2020 through December 31st, 2020. Any deferred taxes must be repaid, though, and that bill is due beginning January 1st, 2021 through April 30th, 2021. The presidential directive allows for tax payment deferment, but does not currently allow for tax forgiveness. There has been a lot of confusion surrounding this issue. Joining us on today's program is Michael G. Radich. He's a CPA, member of the Pennsylvania Institute of Certified Public Accountants. Mr. Radich, welcome to the program.
Glad to be back. Thanks, Scott.
Karen Young is president of HR Solutions and a senior certified professional with the Society of Human Resource Managers. Karen Young, good to have you on the program today.
Great to be here. Just a quick correction. It's HR Resolutions. HR Solutions is a competitor in California.
Okay, Resolutions it is. Thank you very much for making that correction. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Now, as I said, there is a lot of confusion surrounding this, so we're going to try to answer some of the basic questions out there. So both of you feel free to jump in with your answers here. But for those who may not look at their pay stubs when they're paid, what is this tax? Who wants to take that one?
I'll let the CPA jump in on that one.
Well, thank you. The tax deferment that we're talking about here is the 6.2% employee portion of your Social Security taxes. So that is what we would consider a self-employment tax for those who are self-employed, but basically it's a total amount withheld is 12.4%, 6.2% is paid by the employee, and then it's matched by the employer on a per pay period basis.
So is it 6.2 for all employees?
Yes. Yeah, it's a flat rate.
Okay. Does this money go directly to fund the Social Security fund?
Well, the answer is it's supposed to, and I'm sure that it does. Our Social Security system, you know, without getting into the politics of it, is a little bit broken as we know it. So it's kind of a curious deferral situation that we're.
But I think I think for our intent and purposes here, yes, that 6.2% is the employee's contribution toward Social Security.
Mm-hmm. So without getting into the politics of it, and it's hard not to, I know, but if this is not paid by the employee or the employer, then mm-hmm. that has an impact on Social Security overall, correct?
Well, the challenge is it will be paid by the employee. It's just a deferral, not a forgiveness.
Okay.
So
okay.
Just because it's not being paid, if an employer opts to offer this and make it available, the money, and this is from an HR standpoint and an employee relations standpoint, this is my challenge with it, because it's a deferral, not forgiveness, which means I have this 6.2% in to use in my paycheck through December 31st, but then starting in January of 2021, I'm going to be paying 12.4% because I have to pay my 2021 Social Security 6.2%, plus I have to repay this deferral. So in essence, I'm doubling up. So I'm giving more money out of my paycheck come January.
Michael, what were you going to say?
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things that if an employer would decide to participate in this, and we're going to talk about that in just a moment, if an employer would decide to participate in this, the employee would benefit on their paychecks between now and December 31st, but after that, then it's time to pay the piper.
Correct. Pay me now, pay me later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So basically, after the first of the year, you're paying all that money back. So actually, come January 1st, your paycheck's going down 6.2%.
There is no interest involved in any of this, right?
Well,
correct.
There can be.
Oh, okay. Oh.
So there's a couple different. If you look at the so from a tax perspective, the IRS gave us some guidance under Notice 2020-65. Which was, it's basically an administrative update on this particular executive order. But basically, there's a bunch of there's some problems with this for employers and for employees. So, you know, the first thing to say is that you only qualify to be eligible for the deferral if your biweekly pay is less than or equal to $4,000. So you're looking at about $104,000 a year salary in that situation. But where the issue is, there is not anything in place as the executive order currently stands. So let's say we defer that Social Security tax for you from September 1st to December 31st as an employer, and let's say you leave the first week of January and go somewhere else, we may be stuck on the hook for that, paying your portion back. And then if you are in a situation where you don't pay the money back by April 30th, penalties and interest start to accrue beginning May 1st.
Okay, when you say we, are you talking about the employee or employer?
Well, as the executive order and the guidance currently stands, it's only the employer that's on the hook for this deferment.
Correct.
Okay. See, you know, one of the things, and Michael, I could tell that, you know, some of the terminology, you were trying to find the right terminology. There is, and both of you can respond to this, there has been a lot of confusion surrounding this. Am I correct in saying that?
You are 100% correct. the first thing employees hear is, I don't have to pay this money. They don't hear, I don't have to pay this money right now, but I will have to pay it.
Mm-hmm. Michael, from your perspective, what kind of confusion?
I think it is. It's a situation where, you know, like Karen was saying before, it's a pay me now or pay me later situation, where a lot of things that are... I have, as a CPA, I have been steering my clients away from doing this because I think probably the idea is that there's hope that there will be a forgiveness passed by Congress for this after the election. I'm not 100% sure that we can say that with any amount of confidence that that's going to happen, but then there's very little guidance on what an employer can do in terms of, you know, if an employee has been deferring their taxes and they decide that they want to leave, the IRS notice tells us that we are allowed to make agreements with them, but it doesn't really say what that is. So does that mean that we have to then, on their final paycheck, do we have to withhold all that tax back? How do we do that? What, you know, what are the implications of that?
Yeah, from what I've been reading, even though there have been updates since the president signed this, in August, those updates have really not clarified the situation. And as I can kind of tell from listening to the two of you, that there still is confusion out there about it. But Karen, let me ask you, and I want to make this point, that in this, the employer has the option of deferring the tax. The employee has no say in it whatsoever. Is that correct?
I have not interpreted that way.
Okay.
I believe the employee... Oh, go ahead, Mike.
No, that was me. That was me. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. I've interpreted that the employer can make it available and the employee can choose, yes, I want to participate. But, you know, as a consultant, I have been recommending to my clients that, you know, we not publicize it, but if an employee asks about it, I always say the employee has to talk to mama, being me, because I want to make absolute sure that they have a crystal clear understanding that they will have to pay this money back.
And I've done the exact same thing with my clients. I said, you know, let's not advertise it if an employee is in the know about it and they want to talk to it. Before you allow them to do this, they need to talk to me because I want to make sure that they are understanding what's going on. And, you know, it, at the end of the day, what's kind of telling about this payroll tax deferral is that the House itself has voted and determined not to give their employees the option to do this, nor has the Senate done that either. So if the government's saying, hey, this is a terrible idea, you know, I mean, it's one of the few times I've seen the House and the Senate be in agreement in the last 2 years.
Well, see, now I have to say that from what I've read, I had the opposite interpretation because I saw a question that was asked of can an employee opt in or force the employer to participate, and the answer was no, that the employer held all the cards on this, that the employer could make the decision, but the employee couldn't. Well, let me ask you this, Karen. We'll have to somehow we'll have to clarify that. And it is very unusual. It is very unusual, I will say, that when we are doing an interview with professionals like yourselves, that there are questions like this that we can't answer for sure. But Karen, let me ask you this. What percentage, or do you know of, employers that are participating in this, other than the federal government?
The federal government is the only one. We support over 100 clients. None of ours are.
None of them.
I've had
none of mine either.
Employee question about it. One.
And when we say the federal government, that is the executive branch and the military, because as Michael mentioned, the House and Senate opted out for their employees. So it is the executive branch of the federal government and the military. And from what I understand, the military is not real happy with this because they have no choice in the matter.
Right.
Yeah.
When the IRS is made the decision for their employees that they are participating in it, because I do have, obviously with what I do, I talk to IRS agents on a relatively frequent basis, and have gone and said that we're going to, you know, I'm not allowed to have tax debt as an IRS employee, so I'm going to make estimated payments in the fourth quarter so that when all this is said and done, I don't owe the federal government money, and then, you know, that unloads a whole nother issue in and of itself.
Michael, do IRS agents complain to you privately?
Sometimes. Not always. you know, a lot of them play pretty close to the chest, but I do, there's a couple that, you know, after you work with somebody long enough, you do, I don't know if friends is the right word, but we have mutual respect for each other. I mean, our relationship is adversarial in nature, so
I jest. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about some cuts, well, I should say some feared budget cuts. Nothing is concrete right now, but talking to one of Spotlight PA reporters, Ed Mahan, about a story he wrote about anticipated cuts in human service agencies and programs across the state, with the state looking at a $5 billion budget that's coming up as part of tomorrow's program. But today we're talking about what is known as the well, let me just find it here, the old age survivors and disability insurance tax, or as many people refer to it, the Social Security employees payroll taxes. President Trump signed a memorandum last month that would allow that to be deferred. It's 6.2% off of your paycheck, deferred until the first of the year. It would have to be paid back by the 30th of April at this point. But if you've been listening to our conversation, you can see that there is some confusion about it, and as Karen Young just mentioned, no employers are participating except the federal government, and you know, some the executive branch, and as Michael mentioned, the IRS as well. Our phone number, if you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call. If you would like to send an email, send it to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, our phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Our guest today, Karen Young, president of HR Resolutions and a senior certified professional with the Society of Human Resource Managers. And Michael Radich, a CPA and member of the Pennsylvania Institute of Certified Public Accountants. Again, 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call. One of you touched on this before, but I wanted to kind of expand on it a little bit. One of the questions that has arisen here is whether an employee is terminated. Say the employer opts in. Right now, no one other than the federal government, from what Karen has heard, has opted in. But say an employee is terminated, quits, leaves, goes to another job, whatever. What happens then?
I mean, so right now the guidance from the IRS.
Also. Yeah.
Yeah, the IRS says that employers can pull a lump sum of the deferred taxes from a departing employee's last paycheck, and firms can also make arrangements with workers to collect the funds. But it doesn't really give us any specific guidance on how that looks.
Yeah, and I found the non-answer on whether employers or employees have the controlling choice. So I hopped on to SHRM real quick. There's no requirement to provide the deferral at the employee's request. And there's apparently they reference an article on Bloomberg Tax where an IRS representative said that employers do have the controlling choice, but they really don't say whether the employer can allow an individual employee to participate or not. So because there is no set on that, my standard as an employee relations specialist, my guidance, my recommendation would be the honest conversation with the employee. I would even have them sign something acknowledging that they fully understand this is deferral, not forgiveness. And I would probably allow an individual employee within the employer to participate if they so chose.
Oh, you would. Okay.
But there's a non-answer on this also. You know, whether can an employer say, I'm sorry, we're not participating?
I don't know. I can't recall anything that has been this confusing, or maybe confusion is not the right word, but where there was a lack of information, concrete information like this. I mean, am I wrong here?
Implementation of the FFCRA was as confusing.
All right, what's that?
When they started with the paid leave.
Uh-huh.
Back in April.
Okay. Why was that as confusing?
Because we had, as HR practitioners, we had very little guidance on, well, what are our requirements? What do we have to do? How do we get this certified? Do we just provide it to everybody? The Department of Labor did a great job of keeping their frequently asked questions up to date. Mm-hmm. So I would say this is different because we are not getting the plethora of information and feedback about how to administer this. Mm-hmm. So from that standpoint, I'm standing here throwing my arms up in the air going, I don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm. Michael, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just as confused. I mean, I have to agree with Karen. You know, I had clients asking me about the different family leave and who gets paid what percentage and all that other things that happened back in March and April. You know, it's really strange that the employer would be on the hook for the employee portion mm-hmm. of the taxes. You know, I would think that would be something that they would be easily able to collect through, you know, just a traditional notice. But it's kind of one of those things that I don't know that we're going to have an answer until they kind of start muddling through trying to get this money back in the event that there is no forgiveness.
Now, are there any deadlines for an employer to opt into this, or can they retroactively do it?
I don't know that you'd want to retroactively do that. That would be a payroll nightmare. And depending upon the frequency of your tax payments as an employer, your payroll tax payments.
Well, let me just tell you, the reason I asked that question is because, you know, this was signed by President Trump in August, September 1st. This paycheck is supposed to be the first one that the military will see, the next paycheck, mm-hmm. where the 6.2% will be there. But I was just wondering whether, say, 2 weeks from now, our next pay period, mm-hmm. an employer could say, oh, we are going to participate in this.
I haven't seen anything that says that you couldn't do that.
Correct, yeah. I think they could. I don't know that they would.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially now, since no one is doing it other than the federal government. No.
Yeah.
Do you anticipate any more guidance to be rolled out periodically by the government, or is the government aware that no one is doing this other than themselves?
I mean, I would assume that the government is dimly aware of it. You know, I don't know. I don't know that they're. You know, I'm not even sure how they would be able to track. Now, I mean, I've read a bunch of articles.
Right.
You know, and you know, we've seen things that there were companies that came out: Home Depot, UPS, FedEx, J.P. Mm-hmm. Morgan Chase, Costco. All of them said, mm-hmm. "Hey, we're not participating in this," and that's just the way it's going to be.
Right. Yeah.
We have a question from a listener who... Go ahead, Karen. What were you going to say?
Well, I think in theory, it was a great idea.
To put money back in people's pockets.
I get it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We had a question from a listener who says, how will this mm-hmm. impact Social Security for retirees?
I mean, so it was funny, you know, I was thinking about that as well. And so, mm-hmm. you know, if you had the maximum salary, which was the $4,000 biweekly, that means that biweekly you'd have an extra $248 in your paycheck, which doesn't sound like a whole lot. Even when you go through a quarter, you know, let's say that there's, you know, six or seven payrolls in there, you're not talking about a lot of money in the individual, but then you have a couple hundred million people that do it, and it becomes a problem. You know, it's we're already in a system that I think is set up that it's eight people withdrawing for every one person paying in right now.
Wow.
Had another question here about those who maybe are paid by commission. What about overtime? What about bonuses? How are those paychecks impacted?
Well, the 6.2% comes off of gross wages.
Right. And you pay Social Security tax on your first $137,700 of wages.
So it really doesn't matter whether you're paid by salary, hourly, commission, bonus, whatever. It's determined by gross pay.
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I see in the notice.
Okay. Let's see. You know, one of the things that President Trump has talked about, and, you know, we know there's a lot of election year stuff going on right now. But he has said that he may forgive this tax if he is reelected. Now, some see that as pure politics. I'm not going to get you to comment on that. But could those federal governments, those federal government employees and military be winners if this tax is forgiven?
They could be. I mean, so I've, one of my credentials is that I have a master's degree in taxation, and the first semester that I took that degree was on how tax law has developed over the last 100 years. You know, the thing that I'm concerned about here is that if you read the Constitution, the anything that has to do with taxes has to originate in the House. So I'm not even sure how much this holds up as an executive order, given that the origination clause in, I think it's Article 1, Section 6, says that any legislation regarding taxes must originate in the House of Representatives.
Hmm. Yeah, I have to admit, no, I'm no constitutional scholar, but
nor am I.
Any means, but I had to, I wondered about that myself, how this could be done by a presidential memorandum rather than something, you know, that was done in the Congress. So, you know, at this point, though, with so few, I don't know whether someone goes to court against it or not, but with so few employees and employers participating in this, they may not think that it's worth it at this point. So what happens from here? I mean, I think that our audience could probably tell we have a lot of questions ourselves. So if I ask, what happens from here with this? Do we know how to answer the question?
Not really, no. No. I'll say it.
No. I'm standing here thinking I sound like an idiot, but yeah, no.
No, you don't. No, I think what you're doing is you were showing that, you know, a couple of professionals that are do very well in their own professions don't have the answers, so there have to be a lot of other Americans out there that don't as well. Let's take a phone call from Patrick. Patrick, you're on the line. Okay, maybe not. Maybe I don't have Patrick on the line. All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for being with. You know, one thing, Karen, since I have you on the line, I want to take this opportunity to ask something that's not related to the payroll tax.
Sure.
You know, during this tough time when so many people have lost their jobs or have hours cut back, people working from home, what can you tell us about the employment situation just among your clients, and what your observations that you have seen? Things get any better? What do you see?
Things are getting better. Heading into this, pre-COVID, it was the worst recruiting market I have ever worked in my career, and I have over 30 years in personnel and HR. And then post-COVID, I think now that we're through the extended unemployment benefits, people are going to be more actively looking for work, and it truly is an employer's market now for candidates and for staffing. The challenge being is there are a lot of lower-level positions, customer service, retail, and those aren't positions that lend themselves to a work-from-home environment. So there's still going to be a little bit of a lag. But, I mean, for example, I had to replace an HR manager during all of this. And I had probably one of the best responses I've ever had and ended up hiring two HR managers because both brought excellent skills to the table. So I hired ahead of budget, holding my breath still on that, but it was the right thing to do. So the candidates are out there. I'm seeing higher response rates of more qualified candidates now than I have in a really long time.
Do you anticipate that there will be a lot of employees that will continue to work at home, maybe even permanently after this?
I believe so. It is one of the, if any positive has come out of this, It is one of the areas in which I think this has opened employers' eyes to the fact that employees can be effective working from home. They can get their work done. The work doesn't necessarily have to be done in a traditional 9-to-5. Employees can figure out how to work from home and have a home life as well. So it is a positive.
Michael, let me turn to you. Mm-hmm. We are a few months away from people thinking about preparing their tax returns for 2020. What has all this done for, you know, what will be different as they do that before April 15th of next year?
I mean, it's hard right now, you know, because we have a presidential election coming up November 3rd, and there is a tremendous difference in the tax policy proposed by both candidates. I have kind of been telling my clients that, you know, I will start talking about this after the election and when we can see kind of which direction things are going in. But I think we're going to find this year it's going to be similar to in years past, where I don't know that the IRS is going to open up right away in January, you know, maybe that second or third week of January to start filing your 1040s and getting your refunds, because I'm not sure that we're going to have everything that we need in place in terms of what the tax forms are going to look like and, you know, does it make sense? I mean, and logically, you know, based on 17, 18 years in the industry, I'm sitting here saying that if, you know, they deferred their payroll taxes, that it would be easy to do to recoup that via their 1040 filing. But it doesn't seem that, at least currently, that's how that's going to be done. I just think we have too much up in the air right now for individuals and businesses. We still haven't, you know, we're sitting in this position now where if you received, you know, PPP funding, can you or can you not deduct those expenses? Currently, you can't because you're not getting taxed on the PPP loan proceeds. I think it's going to be a very interesting tax season for 2020.
Wow. Michael G. Radich is a CPA, member of the Pennsylvania Institute of Certified Public Accountants. Karen Young is president of HR Resolutions and a senior certified professional with the Society of Human Resource Managers. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. The blood supply in central Pennsylvania is in critical condition. The pandemic set challenging conditions for blood donations from the beginning, and that situation has apparently not improved. Joining us is Patrick Bradley, president and CEO, and Jay Weimer, director of community relations, both with the Central Pennsylvania Blood Bank. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment about you'd like to donate blood or you just have a question, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right. I have to say that describing the situation as being in critical condition is a little bit of a play on words. Patrick Bradley, what is the situation right now with blood supplies in central Pennsylvania?
Well, Scott, regionally, the inventories are pretty tight, both at the hospitals and at the Central Pennsylvania Blood Bank itself. We're currently holding inventories about 60-70% of where we like to be on a normal basis. With blood, the blood that we have on our shelves and the blood that is in the hospital blood banks on their shelves ready to go are really what is most important to the patients that suddenly need a blood transfusion. So you may have donated 3 or 4 days ago, and that blood is now reaching the shelf to be ready for transfusion. And so we need to try to inch that up a little bit. We need about 200 donations a day to feel comfortable in our region And over the past several weeks, we've only been averaging probably about 150 or 160 on a good day.
When you say that 60% of where we would like to be, is that 60% of normal at this time of year or what?
Yes, it's 60% of normal.
From what I understand, Labor Day weekend, for some reason, there's lower than usual blood supplies anyway. Is that correct?
That is correct. And usually the saving grace around Labor Day is after we come out of Labor Day, we usually start in hard with our colleges and high schools. And you know as well as anyone in the listening area that colleges and high schools are on a whole different playing field this year. Some colleges are not in place, and in high schools, a lot of our schools are on a hybrid model where only half the students are in for 2 days and then the other half another 2 days. And with that, those constraints put on education, they're not too willing and able to open their doors to have the blood bank come in and collect blood from those high school and college students.
So Labor Day really has nothing to do with Labor Day other than where it falls at the beginning of classes for high schools and for colleges for the most part. Jay Weimer, is this shortage just a result of not being able to have blood drives?
That's a really large part of it, Scott. You know, we, since March, have not been having our blood drives on blood mobiles. So in a normal month, we would hold about 152 blood drives a month. And now we're holding about 66 blood drives a month in September and what we're planning for in October. And we aren't doing the blood mobile blood drives because to provide social distancing. So we're holding blood drives inside buildings of people who invite us in, churches, businesses, fire halls, to open them to the community and allow us to come in. But yes, we aren't able to hold as many drives as normal.
Are there people, though? I mean, okay, granted, the blood mobile's not out there as much. There's not as many blood drives. I mean, you're talking roughly, a third of what you normally have. But are there people who are hesitant to, I don't know, mix with other people, have IV, a needle stuck in their arm to take blood? Are there people that are hesitant because of COVID-19?
I would have to say yes. We've also seen, at our donor centers, some of that hesitancy as well. We've doubled and tripled our safety measures, of course, on blood drives and donor centers. Of course, all of our staff wear masks, and we practice social distancing, and temperatures are taken at the door. And as a blood center, we already have a very rigorous disinfection procedure, and that's been just increased quite a bit. But yes, I think there's a lot of hesitancy from folks, and we want to assure folks that donating blood is really safe. But I don't think we can overcome everyone's fears.
Something that is different that you are making available is COVID-19 antibody testing. With each successful blood donation at all blood drives and at donation centers, we've actually had a question from a listener about that. Wanted to know, how long does it take to get back the COVID-19 antibody test results once the blood is donated?
Testing, we have testing performed for us every day of the week, 7 days a week, and routinely testing is available within 48 to 72 hours.
As far as getting the results back from the antibodies?
Yes. yes.
Okay. Tell me about that a little bit. How would you describe that? I mean, everyone may not be familiar. They're familiar with a COVID-19 test to find out whether you're positive or negative. Antibody, it hasn't been done quite as much. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the test that they're checking to see if you have active disease of COVID is looking for the virus particles themselves. When a person is infected with something, whether it's COVID or just a common cold or the flu, the normal body's response is to mount what's known as an immune response, where an antibody, which is a protein, is made in your blood, and it is the antibody that will fight the disease, the active disease that is going on, which then in turn helps the individual get better. So that's what we're looking for, is the body's immune response to the COVID virus. And it's important to us because probably a lot of people have heard about COVID convalescent plasma, which is a treatment that is available to patients that are actively sick with COVID. And what it is we and other blood centers across the United States are doing the same thing, is we collect just the plasma part of blood from individuals who have had COVID in the past, and then that is given to individuals that have active COVID disease. And the thinking behind it is that the antibody from the donor will help defeat the disease, defeat the antigen, the COVID antigen, in the patient that's sick in the hospital, and can be an effective treatment for COVID infections.
So not only is donating blood for transfusions important, but exactly what you're talking about with the plasma, that may be one of the keys to keeping some people who are treating some people who have had COVID-19 who have been sick. So this is important as well. Let's take a phone call from Mark. Mark, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Go ahead. What's your question? My question was, I'm a gay man, and in April, the FDA had changed their rules on their recommendations on accepting blood from men who have sex with men, and I had trouble donating back in April. And I know there are three local, the Red Cross, Lancaster General Hospital, and Central PA Blood Bank. Do you know which ones have been able to update their policies for the latest FDA recommendations?
Mark, thank you for your question. Gentlemen?
I can speak for the Central Pennsylvania Blood Bank, and we are following all the changes that were allowed by the FDA. And if Mark had a question, we have a donor advocate here at the Central Pennsylvania Blood Bank that I would say the best thing for Mark to do would be to give us a call at 1-800-771-0059 and ask to speak with our donor advocate, who could walk him through what the requirements of the new regulations are. It's a relaxation of the regulations. It's not a total elimination of the regulation that was in place prior to COVID.
Is that question still being asked when someone is donating blood?
Yes. Yes, it is.
It is. And so you say it's a relaxation rather than totally changing the rule. You know, this has been something for a lot of gay men, especially over the years, that they've had a problem with. If someone answers yes, that they are a gay man and they have had sex with another man, does that automatically keep them from donating blood?
Well, in the past, it was an automatic permanent deferral. You would not be able to donate blood. With the new regulations, it becomes more like a individual that may have used injectable drugs or have had sexual relationships with sex workers or those kind of things. So there's a limit, a time limit from previous risky behaviors and how long that person would be donated or be deferred from donating.
When you say risky behaviors, meaning that the possibility that the blood could be somehow it would not be able to be used for transfusion.
Correct. Okay. So just a simple one, an easier one would be if you traveled to a country where there was a high incidence of malaria, we would have to defer you for a certain period of time. And it's the period of time of a deferral that was relaxed by the FDA. So the regulation has not been wiped off the books. It's just been, as I said before, a little bit more relaxed.
We only have about 3 minutes left, and I want to try to get to as many questions as we can. Laura is on the phone, but I'm going to ask your questions since we have short time. She says, I have B blood type, B as in boy, was told I could not give blood in 1999. Is she able to give blood now?
She is. We need her blood today. Yes, very much so.
Why was she told in 1999, or why would she have been told?
I can't quite imagine why.
Okay.
Patrick,
right.
Dean.
That's one of the difficult things, and it's very individualized. Every person is different, and every person's questions and answers are different. So if you have a question about whether you are eligible to donate, again, they can contact us, and we can put them in direct contact with our donor advocates. She's a registered nurse who has extensive and a lot of knowledge, long-term knowledge on the rules and regulations of blood donation. So that would be my best answer to any individual who is wondering if they are eligible to donate blood.
Yeah, because we actually have a couple other questions from listeners who have specific questions, and I would encourage them, because we are short on time, to call that number and talk with your advocate. Are there some blood types that are in shorter supply than others?
The blood types that we're in shorter supply of right now are group O, both O positive and O negative, and anyone that is Rh negative, meaning A negative, B negative, those are the ones that are in the highest demand and are used most commonly in transfusion.
Mm-hmm.
But we need all blood types right now because, as I said, we're only at about 60 to 70% of our desired levels.
Mm-hmm. So we are almost out of time. We have about a minute left. For those who have been listening and hopefully... I do have one question before I ask that last question of how you can donate. What is the time period between donations? How long do you have to wait?
56 days.
How much is it?
56 days. 56 days or 8 weeks.
Okay, 56 days, 8 weeks. Now I'll ask that final question. For those who are listening and would like to donate blood, how can they do it?
Right now we are asking people to make an appointment to donate blood so that we can ensure that we can maintain social distance. And the best ways to do that is to give the Central Pennsylvania Blood Bank a call. Again, it's 1-800-771-0059, or you can visit our website at 717giveblood.org to find information. We also have a Facebook page, and there's a lot of information on the web on eligibility questions. But as I said, individuals' questions are greatly appreciated, and we can field and answer those questions very easily on a phone call or in an email.
Patrick Bradley is president and CEO. Jay Weimer is director of community relations with the Central Pennsylvania Blood Bank. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
We will talk to you tomorrow morning.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health, online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.